At the end of the Mexican-American War in 1848, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo spelled out that the U.S. would respect Spanish and Mexican land grants in the territory ceded to America, including Arizona. It's in that context that Missouri native James Addison Rivas got an idea.
He thought to himself, this is a really great opportunity for me to steal a bunch of land. He was a con artist. So he took it upon himself to make up a Spanish land grant. And he spent 20 years forging archival documents around the world. And he created this whole narrative of a story of a family. And the one thing that he was missing was an heiress. So he found an orphan, or a person of uncertain parentage, rather, in California, whose name was Sophia, you know, like sort of dark skinned, but nebulous enough that he thought that he could pass her off as Spanish. So he set her up as the heiress to this Peralta land grant, started calling her Sophia Peralta, and married her. And that's how he planned to steal a really good chunk of land. We're talking about an area that's pretty much all of central Arizona into a tiny bit of western New Mexico.
That's Anita Huizar Hernandez, an assistant professor of border studies at the University of Arizona and author of the book Forging Arizona, A History of the Peralta Land Grant and Racial Identity in the West. I spoke with her recently via Skype and asked what kind of impact Rivas' scheming had before he got caught, especially since there were people living on the land he was trying to claim.
Yeah, so it's really interesting if you look back at newspapers from within Arizona and New Mexico during this time, especially the newspapers in Arizona are very hostile to his claim from the very beginning. And you can trace how this was such an important issue, even though a lot of people haven't heard of it today, that it was something that candidates for territorial office were asked about, what's your position on the Peralta land grant? And this was a big deal for people who were living in Arizona at the time.
So what does this whole incident tell us about, I guess, narrative and the ability to frame and craft and maybe latch on to a narrative, whether or not it's actually true?
So I should clarify that even though this is about a historical case study, I am a literature professor by training. My PhD is in literature, and my interest in this was exactly about narrative and stories. And it's something that I think we all know intrinsically, that the stories you know about a place shape your understanding of that place and your interaction with that place. But I was really drawn to the story as an example of how concrete the consequences are of the narratives that we internalize about a place, whether they're true or not.
So when you look at this story and the story that Rivas was able to tell and the people that he was able to convince, until he eventually was not able to convince them anymore because he had to produce documents and a court took a look at them. Do you think that was sort of a function of the times, or is there maybe a more timeless element to what happened there?
So I think both, absolutely. There is an element to, it sounds like a very Wild West kind of story. So it is familiar to us in that way. He certainly wasn't the only person who was doctoring documents, right? He just happened to be a bit more ambitious about it, and that's part of why he got caught. But there are some timeless truths. I think in the book I talk a lot about counterfeit narratives, which is what the sort of frame that I use to think about what his particular story does sort of on an ideological level, and how even a narrative that is counterfeit can still have concrete consequences. And specifically, I look at his wife. What I wanted to do was also look specifically at this person who he chose, Sophia, to craft this narrative around and see how that impacted people's interaction with her, people's descriptions of her. And what's really interesting for me as someone who works in the areas of ethnic studies is that a lot of the trial is consumed not only with handwriting experts and seeing if the documents are authentic or not, but debating a person's racial identity. So about half of the trial is consumed with whether or not Sophia is a Spanish person or not.
I'm wondering, in talking about making narratives and the stories that, you know, that people hear and believe, if you see any parallels between this case And some of what we're seeing now with the increased popularity of DNA testing services and genetic testing services, where people and families are finding out that some of the family histories that they've been told over the years and over the generations aren't exactly true.
Yes, I think that is a perfect example of how we have these ideas in our head that identities and racial identities in particular are fixed in time, and that certain families, certain people, certain names, certain locations are associated with particular racial identities. But of course, life is more complicated, is literally not black and white, right? And so it's interesting to me to see how it throws people for such a loop when they find out that they have these other heritages. Of course, that's going to happen, especially in a space like the United States, but that they can't wrap their head around, or it's just such a paradigm shift to think, oh, the story that I know of my family and the story that I associate with my identity is actually different. And how does that change then my conception of that identity and my conception of my family and my conception of myself, who I am?
How do you think that we should be thinking about that when we find out that something that we thought was true, or maybe even something that we held on to really tightly, isn't entirely accurate, be it something about our family or something about, you know, the history of the place we live?
Right. Yeah, I think something that I was really interested in was taking a case that is extreme, but using it as a lens to think about, well, maybe we should rethink all of the stories that we think we know, right? Personal or more national, right? We think that we know perhaps the history of a place like Arizona, right? But there's a lot more nuance and a lot more complexity there. And perhaps if we knew more of that nuance, more of that complexity, we would have a different understanding of certain, you know, political debates that are happening in the state, or a different understanding of policies that various people propose, or different goals, and imagine a different shared future, right? Because the way we imagine our shared future is necessarily tied up with how we imagine our shared past.
Anita Huizar-Hernandez is an assistant professor of border studies at the University of Arizona and author of the book Forging Arizona, A History of the Peralta Land Grant and Racial Identity in the West.